Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
This week marks the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and the news is filled with footage of various veterans, all over 100, who have gone back to France. We're used to thinking about World War II in physical terms, the strategy and tactics used to marshal personnel and machines to fight the Axis powers. But there was another kind of war being fought by the United States, one that actually predated Pearl Harbor. In 1939, the U.S. Department of Treasury began a clandestine effort to undermine the Nazi regime through economic warfare. Author Graham Moore has written a fictionalized history of that effort, albeit one that is based on real people and real events. We are very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Graham, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
This is a really amazing story. Why did you choose to write it as a novel, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Gosh, the research process was certainly a couple of years long. When I first found this story, I was shocked that, frankly, no one had ever written about it before. Mm-hmm. It felt like there was this secret history of the Second World War that I had been let in on. And frankly, one of the first things that clued me into it was I was reading sort of a bit around topics kind of related to it and what the Treasury Department was doing during the war. And then I found a wonderful scholar named Rebecca Erbelding at the U.S. Holocaust Museum in D.C. And I was asking her questions about some of these figures, and specifically this man, Ansel Luxford, who I wanted to write the book about. And I said, well, do you think there's more of a story here than kind of has been told? And she said, well, actually, in the basement of the Treasury Department library, I found this box. And inside the box was 700 pages of firsthand accounts of this unit and what they'd done during the war. The box was recently declassified, and honestly, as far as I know today, Rebecca is the only person who's ever opened this box. She's the only person who's ever seen it. The accounts inside are this amazing history of this secret unit, and it's all written first person plural. It's kind of, we did this, and then we did that, and we did this other thing. And she said, you know, I have this box. I couldn't take it out of there, but on my cell phone, I took 700 iPhone photographs, one of every page. Do you want me to send you the photographs? And I said, yes. And sure enough, the next day, 700 iPhone photographs show up in the mail, on my phone. And it was this amazing trove of information about the secret unit. And I think from my perspective, because I could write historical fiction, and because so much of this history is lost to the murky and clandestine nature of spycraft, the ability to write it as historical fiction, albeit one that's very much sketched on a canvas of reality, all kind of real characters, real events, it allowed me to fill in the gaps where the historical record was absent.
So let's set the stage for the listeners here. You referenced the unit, and so let's talk about the so-called Treasury Research Department. What did it do, and why were their efforts clandestine?
So in 1939, when the war in Europe broke out, this is after the invasion of Poland, the percentage of Americans who wanted to get involved in any way in what they call the European dispute was 12%. We have quite good polling on this. The percentage of Americans who wanted to get involved militarily in the European dispute, that was 2%. Which meant that for the Roosevelt administration, it was politically toxic to have anything to do with this European war. The government was quite clear. We could not pick sides. We could not pick sides between the Nazis and the British. We could not pick sides between the Nazis and the French. And yet, what I found was that there was this team at Treasury who said, no, we're not going to remain neutral in the face of what is clearly a catastrophic terror to civilization as we know it. And we're not spies, and we're not the military. We're economists. So we're going to do whatever it is that we can to take the war to the Germans' doorstep, which in their case meant hitting them in the wallet.
And the book sort of paints a picture of sort of, I don't know whether benign neglect is the right term, or sort of benign ignorance, where this was going on, but people above it were sort of pretending that it didn't really happen, but also casually supporting it. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, I think that was one of the dynamics that I found most fascinating as I began the research process here, that our team of people went to the Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, who then went to the president, and Morgenthau went to the president and basically said, look, I know we've passed a neutrality act. By law, the United States right now has to remain neutral. By law, no one in the government can do anything to seem to be supporting the British or to seem to be supporting the French. And yet, I've got some guys at Treasury who aren't going to do that and who have some plans and want to do some things. And is that going to be a problem? And from the records we have, the president's response to that was basically putting his hands over his ears and saying, nah, 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 I didn't hear that. You were never here. You didn't tell me that. Let's pretend this conversation never happened, and this better not show up in the newspapers. Whatever they do is their business, and as long as I never hear about it again, I'm not going to ask you any more questions. And that's, I think, yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, and one of the wonderful things that we're going to get to is how clever these people were at creating measures that were ostensibly neutral, but were actually designed to be helpful to Britain and France.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about is one of the first things that this Treasury Research Department needed to do is figure out how the German war machine ran. And I thought it was very interesting and a good point in the book where you didn't necessarily need to speak German. You know, these are economists. They could just look at numbers and start to try to figure out how things came together. So what was the truth that they recognized about the importance of how German had manipulated their economy?
Exactly. So the great question that they were looking at beginning in 39 was, in just 5 years previous, in 1933, Germany was a backwater. It was crippled by nearly two decades of crushing poverty. It had been saddled by war debts after the First World War, so severe that it went through first an inflationary spiral, then a deflationary spiral. It was just an economic disaster for 20 years by the early 30s. And then, within 5 years, they built the largest military in the world. And so what this team at Treasury was looking at was, how on earth did they do that? From what kind of miracle oil was this enormous military power built? And then, once we figure out what this miracle oil is, how do we light the thing on fire? And among the things they realized are that the German war machine was, on some level, an extremely complicated Ponzi scheme, in that it was a machine that ran on conquest and theft. That is, the machine first required them to steal wealth and supplies from Germany's own Jewish population. And then it required the German economy to continue to take new lands, new populations, new wealth and raw material that it could effectively steal as it rampaged throughout Europe, as well as new, frankly, cash that it could get its hands on. And so what this team realized was that for people who were saying, oh, perhaps the Germans would stop at Czechoslovakia, perhaps they would stop at the invasion of Poland, perhaps they would stop here or stop there, it was economically unfeasible. The entire German economy would crash if they stopped trying to invade the rest of Europe. The whole machine was built on conquest, and they simply needed to keep going. And so one of the questions they got into was, all right, they're going to keep going, and whether the British and the French know it yet, frankly, whether anyone in the White House knows it yet, this isn't going to stop. So how do we kind of poke at the weak spots in this system?
One of the really interesting things that is pointed out early in the book is this concept of MIFO bills. And again, a lot of these characters, and I take it almost all these characters in the book are real. One of them is this guy, Halmar Schacht. Can you explain to him who he was? Because, you know, of all the Nazi figures, all those names we've heard, he's not one that, you know, people are really familiar with. And I take it his concept of powering the German war machine through both conquest and these so-called MIFO bills was pretty important. Can you briefly explain that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Halmar Schacht was a fascinating figure in the German government. I might argue that he was the smartest of the Nazis, which is perhaps a strange compliment to May. Such was his devilishness. The British economists had nicknamed him the Dark Wizard of Global Finance, which is a sort of a terrifying and awe-filled name. Hallmarschacht was the head of the German Reichsbank, and he was the designer of the German wartime economy. And it's funny, this book is a novel and it's a thriller, and it's been funny talking to people since it's just come out and about how it's a thriller where there's a whole section of the kind of thriller plot that revolves around MIFO bills, this particular German corporate bond system. And you don't see a lot of thrillers that revolve around specifics of German corporate bonds from the mid-1930s. And yet, so important were MIFO bills to the German war machine. Figuring out how to combat them was a huge part of what these clandestine economists in America were doing. So Schacht had basically built this system whereby German citizens would, when they would deposit money into banks, the banks would, as usual, reinvest those deposits. The German banks were hugely incentivized to reinvest those deposits in this company called MIFO, M-E-F-O. It stands for something quite long in German. And the MEFO company was a fake company. It was secretly set up by the Reich and didn't exist, didn't produce anything. It was this purely paper fiction. And what it did was it guaranteed 4% returns on all of its bonds, which was quite a lot for corporate bonds in the period. And so people would deposit their money into the bank. The banks would then reinvest them. They were hugely encouraged to reinvest them in these kind of MIFO corporate bonds, which everyone at the banks kind of knew was basically this shell company for the Nazi government. And meanwhile, as the banks were kind of putting everyone's deposits into MIFO, MIFO would tell everyone, oh, you're returning 4% every year. They're kind of showing all these paper profits, only they would never actually give the money back. And there were limits on the amount that people could withdraw from, say, their checking accounts in the bank. So effectively it functioned like a terrifically elaborate Ponzi scheme where everyone's bank savings deposits were getting kind of thrown into this MIFO company, and they were being shown that they could, that they were returning all these profits, only the profits couldn't be withdrawn and never actually sort of showed up. Now the question is, okay, what did the MIFO Corporation do with the money? It spent it on the military. It spent it entirely on weapons of war. And that is how the Germans were secretly funneling money into their military and how they were secretly funding the war machine. A substantially bigger percentage of the German economy was devoted towards war material than anyone knew about. And Schacht kind of devised the system. He implemented it. It was brilliant because it allowed the German government to, brilliant and evil, I should point out, because it allowed the German government to build this massive war machine without it appearing that that's what they were doing. They were basically spending double the percentage of their GDP on their military than it appeared from the outside.
I have to just side note this. I thought it was fascinating that GDP didn't come up until the 1930s. And you brought it about, you talked about it a little bit in the book, but one of the things going back to the book as well is you took us on a trip to South America that the members of the research department took, and they wanted to try some initiatives that ended up being unsuccessful. Can you talk a little bit about who they went to talk with and what that discussion was about?
So one of the things they were trying to figure out as they were effectively inventing the concept of economic warfare as we know it today, which is what our team at Treasury was tasked with doing. This kind of economic warfare had frankly never been done before. And so one of the things they realized as they were attempting to wage this and figure out what it might look like was, the question they were confronted with was, okay, the Germans are on this massive conquest across Europe, and they can keep kind of stealing material, they can steal steel, they can steal all sorts of chemicals and raw materials from the rest of Europe, they can certainly steal money from the countries they're taking over, but what are the things they can't get a hold of? And how do we stop their ability to get some? And one of the things that our team at Treasury realized so brilliantly was cotton. Cotton was a weak link because you can't make cotton in Germany, and frankly, there was no good way in the immediate territory they were confiscating to kind of grab huge amounts of it. No one was making cotton anywhere near there. And in fact, they were buying all of their cotton from Brazil. So to the Treasury Department, this was a weak spot. This was an Achilles heel in the German economy because, yes, at the time, Germany had this non-aggression pact with Stalin. They said, famously, Germany had vowed not to invade the Soviet Union and vice versa. But our team at Treasury knew, well, that can't last because Germany can't keep expanding only south and west. They're going to have to expand east. Hitler may say he's not going to invade Russia, but he's going to have to do this. So the thing, though, is that the Soviet winters are cold. And if you want to invade, you frankly need uniforms for the soldiers. You need a lot of cotton to power this. So what our team at Treasury did was they went to Brazil, and they went to the Brazilian government and representatives of Brazilian cotton producers and said, look, you're selling all this cotton to Germany, and you're saying you're neutral in the war, and that's fine. We're not telling you not to be neutral. We're not telling you to pick sides. We're neutral. We're not even officially picking sides. We want to buy all your cotton from you, and we want to buy it at a better rate than you're going to get from the Germans. And this was brilliant. This allowed them to effectively overpay for tons of Brazilian cotton that would then be brought back to the U.S., and they could simultaneously invest in Brazilian cotton production. This was politically complicated in the United States because you imagine how the southern states would react to the feeling that, to the suggestion that, oh, suddenly the United States is going to be importing cotton. That has not been economically what the United States has done historically. But it was this brilliant system to figure out, okay, what's this weak link in the German war machine, and how do we sever off their trade relationship with Brazil? This became one of the big tactics they were using. It was, okay, what are things that Germany is trying to import, and how do we kind of snip that import-export route economically without, as discussed before, without it looking like that's what we're doing? We're just making trades. We're just buying cotton from Brazil. There's nothing, that doesn't look like warfare. That's just a trade, when in fact it was very much warfare indeed.
Another one of those kinds of measures which I found just brilliant was this notion of foreign fund control. And why don't you explain how that worked and how it was, on the one hand, ostensibly neutral, but clearly not.
So one of the other things that they were looking at was how to stop the Germans from buying all sorts of things on the global markets. As discussed before, the German war machine is being fed with this kind of NIFO bill economy. But so many countries in the world weren't going to take Reichsmarks. They're not going to accept payment for their goods, for their exports in Reichsmarks. And they're certainly not going to accept payment for goods in MIFO bills, which is this kind of the Ponzi scheme part of it that only exists in Germany. So foreign funds control was this attempt to say, all right, various German companies and frankly the German government has money stashed in all sorts of banks around the United States, around the world. How do we cut off their access to it? And so what we did, when I found this in the historical record, I was shocked to see we did this. The Treasury Department hired 10,000 accountants, and we placed an accountant in nearly every single bank branch across the United States. And any time anyone wanted to send money into or out of Europe or anywhere close to a German-controlled area, basically one of these accountants had to make sure that money wasn't going to end up back in German hands. Our great fear was that the Germans would get control of dollars or gold that they could then use on the global markets to buy more of, say, the cotton or the things that we were also cutting off their access to. And so it was this, the bankers threw up their hands and screamed bloody murder about this. You can only imagine how all these bank owners would react to the Treasury kind of coming in and saying, yep, we're going to install our people in all of your banks, and we're going to hold up your transactions, and you can't send money in and out of Europe without our permission, and deal with it. And Wall Street was kind of livid about this. But what it allowed the U.S. government to do was stop Germany from getting access to money that it could do on the global market. And you see in the invention of this system, it was called foreign funds control, and this clandestine team at Treasury was running it, you see there the forerunner of, frankly, exactly what the US government and the EU are doing to the Russian government right now, where both entities are frantically trying to cut off the Russian government's access to dollars or euros and sever Russia from the global market in exactly the same way. And I think that was one of the shocking things about working on this book, was sort of seeing how these techniques that this clandestine group developed in 1939 were a set of techniques that were then exactly replicated in somewhat more complicated modern ways by the United States and the EU in the last 2 years.
And as a reader, it definitely, those two ties, it makes it even more interesting. I want to go to what role the Treasury played in the cash and carry and lend lease programs. Can you talk about what and how they got around some rules and regulations there?
Yeah, so one of the things they were looking at was, how do we support the British war effort and how do we support the French war effort without it seeming that that's what we're doing? Because of the Neutrality Act, they couldn't seem to be picking sides, right? So at the same time, the British government was caught flat-footed. They were a step behind. They had not built up nearly the war machine required to handle a war with Germany. Certainly the French were in the same position. If you look at the military statistics in 1939, the German government was the German military was leagues bigger than the British military, than the French military, than the American military combined. It's very easy. I think sometimes when we talk about the Second World War, we look back on it with a bit of kind of rose-colored glasses and sort of go, oh yes, the good guys won. Of course the good guys won. The good guys were always going to win. And certainly from reading a lot about 1939 and 1940, I think if you were alive then, just the opposite was the case. The German military was so much larger than the soon-to-be Allied powers that it did not feel like the good guys were about to win. So the question facing the team at Treasury was, in the face of being wildly outmanned and outpowered, how do we support our allies without it seeming like that's what we were doing? Effectively, what they had to do was finance not just the American military buildup, but finance the British war machine and the French war machine without appearing to do so. And so what we came up with was first cash and carry, which became lend-lease. And this was sort of generated under this clandestine team at Treasury. And the idea was, we were going to open up the world's largest arms dealership. We're going to sell arms neutrally. The United States can make a lot of weapons. We're happy to finance the making of weapons. And we're just going to sell them on the global market to anyone who will buy. We'll sell to the Germans. We'll sell to the Soviets. We'll sell to the Japanese. We can sell to the British. We'll sell to whomever. But, and this is what our team at Treasury came up with that's so particularly brilliant, but there's a little fine print on the sale. We're not going to do two things. First, we're only going to accept payment in US dollars, which is funny because Germany did not have much dollar stockpiles, while Britain and France did. And then the second caveat was, we don't do shipping. If you want to buy weapons from us, happy to sell them to you, but you have to come pick them up yourselves. And they knew, of course, that only the British and the French had the shipping routes to send their ships to the United States, pick up weapons, and bring them back to Europe, whereas Germany obviously could not do that. So it was this kind of brilliant system where we set up we appeared neutral. We appeared as this kind of arms dealer to the world, but at the same time put in place these sort of caveats, this fine print on the sale, that meant that we were only actually in practice selling weapons to British and French and the Britain and France. And then, even more sneakily, we gave them effectively indefinite loans to pay back the money they were borrowing on those sales. So they didn't have to pay right away. So we were effectively just giving Britain and France lots of weapons without it in any way seeming like that's what we were doing.
Graham, that we could probably go on for another half an hour, but unfortunately we are out of time. The book is marvelous. There are other topics such as the role of John Maynard Keynes, what happened to Bretton Woods. We could go on and on. But thank you for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. This has been terrific.
On May 14th, during his keynote address at the Wasatch Back Economic Summit, Robert Spendlove made a surprising statement, offering that maintaining high mortgage rates is beneficial, especially here in Utah. Joining us this morning to walk us through his thoughts is Robert Spendlove, senior economist with Zions Bank. Robert, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's great to be with you.
Let's begin. During the Wasatch Back Economic Summit, you were charged with providing an economic overview of the state of Utah and Wasatch Back. What key factors did you include as part of your presentation to kind of give this overview?
Yeah, so the economic indicators that I'm watching really closely right now, the big one that everyone is watching is inflation. It's the issue that is on top of mind for everyone. And then the second one, if you think about the Federal Reserve, I'm a Fed watcher, and the Fed has a dual mandate to focus almost entirely on inflation and employment. And so that's the other one that we're watching really closely, the labor market. We got a new inflation read last week, and then we're getting a new jobs report on Friday. So those are the ones we're watching really closely. And then related to that is interest rates and kind of our financial markets and their reaction to these economic indicators.
So as you started walking the audience through these indicators, you showed some slides. And of course, here on the radio, you're not able to kind of show graphs and slides, so we're going to walk through this verbally. But can you provide listeners with a sense of where we currently are with mortgage rates and why that was a key topic to this presentation?
Yeah, and so that's where it goes from kind of being this high level, you know, economic indicators to being on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so the way the Fed, the Federal Reserve, they have a few different tools that they use, but one of their main tools is interest rates. And so as the economy started to overheat following the pandemic, the Fed raised the federal funds rate, which is the very shortest term interest rate. They raised it from 0% up to 5%. Right now it sits around 5.3%. And that kind of pushes through to the rest of the yield curve to longer term interest rates. And so it's had that same effect on mortgage rates, where 3 years ago, mortgage rates were around 3%. And now they're hovering around 7%. So that's caused some big distortions in our housing market and kind of throughout the economy.
And, you know, as we go through the year, everybody's sort of watching the Fed to see if they're going to make an interest rate cut. Where do you think we are, particularly after last week's inflation numbers?
You know, that's the toughest question. So, and if I can just back up a little bit. So the Federal Reserve has indicated their latest forecast. They started this forecast in December. We got a new one 6 weeks ago, and we'll be getting the next one later this month. They had said they're going to cut rates three times in 2024. Markets didn't believe them. Markets thought they're going to cut rates six times in 24. I think even three times is too much. I think we're down to maybe two times or one times, and that would be whenever they cut, it's usually about 25 basis points. So what I'm thinking is maybe 25 to 50 basis points. So we're not going to change a lot, and it really depends on if we see signs of that overheating that we've been seeing for the last few years slowing down. This is why, you know, they call economists the dismal scientists. I'm a little bit excited that we've seen some slowing. The number on Friday was the personal consumption expenditure, and we saw a little bit of slowing there. We saw consumer spending starting to slow. So there are some good signs that we've seen slowing. The jobs report on Friday is going to be critical. We need to see that softening in the labor market. We need to see average wages continuing to slow. But we're kind of on this. The Fed is walking this tightrope of trying to slow the economy but not push it into a contraction.
So I listen to you and I listen to, you know, other economists in the news, and I know that I'm waiting for inflation to go down. and that when inflation grows down, that the feds could cut the interest rates. But at the economic summit where you spoke, you had said something that you had said, you know, as cautionary, like that may not be a good thing for Utah if the mortgage rates go down. And I feel like that was surprising to me. Can you start to walk us through about that statement and why you feel that way?
Yeah, and this is a really tough part. And one of our struggles with our inflation we've had different sectors of overheating. And if you go back early in the pandemic, it was all because of the breakdown in the supply chain. So we had big increases in consumer goods because we couldn't leave our houses. So what we did was we went on Amazon and spent like crazy. So that caused that surge in goods, surge in food prices. And then over the last few years, we've seen goods prices coming back down. Well, I should say the inflation is slowing in goods prices, but we haven't seen enough slowing in the housing sector, where housing inflation continues to remain one of the drivers of our overall inflation. And we've been kind of waiting for this to slow down, but it's not slowing down enough, where housing is really leading our overall inflation. And so, you know, one of the effects that the Fed wants to cause is with these higher mortgage rates, their hope is to slow down that inflation in housing. If they allow that mortgage rate to come back down to that 3% level again, it will reheat the housing inflation and could cause overall inflation to surge even more.
The wheels are spinning in my head as I'm trying to think about this. Okay, because when you think about it, if one would think that based on fundamental supply and demand, if higher mortgage rates are creating a real increase in the sort of real cost to a consumer of buying a house, that would create in and of itself downward pressure on housing prices. Yet we're not seeing it. What am I missing?
Well, and the problem was for certainly from about 2015 to 2020, but then even more so in 2020 and 2021, interest rates were too low. So if you think about, we've had this era of historic distortions in interest rates where, and you have to back up to the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, the Fed took that Fed funds rate and pushed it all the way down to zero. It had never been zero in the history of our country. And so that pushed down interest rates across the board, and not just the mortgage rate. If you look at the 10-year bond, it was very low as well. So what does that do when you have very low interest rates? It makes access to capital cheaper. And so it grows some areas like the tech sector, like startups and like housing. And that was the goal, but they left that Fed funds rate at zero for about 15 years. So that's a generation of very low interest rates that was spurring this growth. The Fed started to raise those rates in the late 20-teens, but then when the pandemic hit, they pushed it back down to zero to try to spur economic growth, and it caused this inflation that we're seeing now. So now they're having to reverse that to try to bring it down. But you've got this kind of pendulum of these historic factors that are distorting these markets.
So we know that when mortgage rates go high, people don't move and change homes as frequently, but there was a stat and a slide that you were able to show during the economic summit of how Utah ranks with regards to mortgage rates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and so our mortgage rates are similar to the nation, but because our prices have surged so much, it's caused some big impacts to our housing market. So let me just give you a little bit of specific data. So according to Zillow, the typical home price in America is about $359,000. In Utah, it's now $523,000. And just as a reference, in Summit County, it's $1.3 million. As recently as 2006, Utah home prices were at the national average. Now we're significantly higher than the national average. The result of that is, if you kind of think about, we call it the rule of three. So home prices should be about three times household income. And if you looked at the median home price in Utah compared to the median household income, it was 3 to 1 as recently as 2012. Today it's 6 to 1.
Wow.
And so housing is just completely unaffordable. And it's great if you own a home, right? Those of us that own a home, we're saying, great, we've got all this extra money. What if you're just trying to get into a home? If you're young, just coming out of college, or if you're low income, we've essentially boxed them out of the market.
And as you sit here and think about that, you sort of wonder, how do we get out of this hole? I mean, where do we go from here that sort of restores some kind of equilibrium? Are we looking at the probability of a substantial decrease in housing prices and housing costs in order to get there?
Well, and that's where it gets really tough. To equalize this, you either need to have a big reduction in home prices, so you know a crash like we saw after the Great Recession, or you have to have a substantial increase in income, which we are seeing. But you know, a substantial increase in income also is inflationary.
Right.
So the Fed's trying to keep the housing market from collapsing, but also prevent that out of control inflation. Another solution is, none of these solutions are great. You have to have higher density, and you've got to have cheaper, not just less expensive, but actually cheaper housing stock. And you know, when I think about my first home, you know, it was one of those, it was 1,100 square feet with a carport. You cannot buy an 1,100 square foot house with a carport anymore. And so we've got to have kind of this reassessment of what we demand and what we provide to home buyers.
One of the stats, and I don't know necessarily or can't recall how this plays into the equation, but that Utah, I think, ranks the top for the lowest rate mortgages or number of mortgages under 3%. Is it under 3%?
Or? Under 4%.
Yeah.
So this is an analysis of existing mortgages with a rate that's 4% or lower. In Utah, 72% of homeowners have a rate below 4%. And Utah is the highest in the country. On the other extreme is West Virginia, where it's about 49%. So if you just think about that, we're locking in. I mean, those people with under a 4% mortgage are not going to refinance. They're not going to move. And so the only solution is we've got to build more homes.
Yeah, and because mathematically, if I'm sitting here with a 4% loan and I want to buy, normally I would want to move up, right? My family has grown. I'm at the next stage of my life. I would sell my home and buy a slightly larger one. The economic significance of that, just if I go to a 7% loan, the cost of moving up would just be sort of forbidding, right? So, and that's the freeze concept you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other side, too, let's say that you're an older couple. Your kids have moved out of the house and you're saying, well, it's too big. Now I want to trade down. But if you trade down, you're going to pay more. So people just say, well, okay, then I'm just never going to leave. And so it just freezes up all these different stages of home progression.
The research that you've done and the way that you've been able to explain this, I think, is super helpful and unique in that many Utahns aren't aware of kind of the details that you've gone into today. And I really appreciate the time you've been spending with us. We've been speaking with Robert Spendlove. He's the senior economist with Zions Bank. Robert, thanks for spending time with Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
Nestled mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, Goldner Hirsch is a Bavarian-inspired inn that provides a variety of bucket list adventures for their guests. Drawing inspiration from its Austrian namesake, their culinary team deftly marries Bavarian specialties with farm-fresh regional fare sources from local pastures. Joining us this morning to share more with us about their offerings is Goldner Hirsch's executive chef, Senthil Krishnamurthy. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. It's great to speak with you today.
Yes, thank you. So Let's begin. For listeners not familiar with the Goldner Hirsch, can you give them an overview of the property and its Austrian connection?
Certainly. Goldner Hirsch is a charming family-owned hotel in Deer Valley, known for its luxurious amenities, farm-fresh food, beautiful mountain views. We're located conveniently right by the base of Deer Valley Lift. Goldner Hirsch has been one of the most upscale hotels in that area since it's been founded in 1992. It's designed to resemble an Austrian chalet, and the Bavarian spirit is still celebrated in every aspect of the property.
So tell us a little more about sort of how the hotel remains connected to its Austrian roots.
Living in Utah, we have this great luxury to share the same climate and geography as the Alpine and the Bavarian region, which helps us to use similar kind of products, especially when it comes to food. And the restaurant has always been a gathering place for the locals and the visitors alike to come together and enjoy exceptional Utah cuisine, which is inspired by the Alpine and the Bavarian theme that we are going for here. We also have other outlets like Antler Lounge for an apres cocktail, and the Kids Cafe, which we are known for our authentic pastry. I grew up in a French town, so I care a lot about it, so I make sure they're the exact way you have it in France.
That's wonderful. So I know that with the menus that you know, have an ode to, like with the pastry shop or with the restaurant to kind of the Bavarian culture, as you change the menus with each season, you tend to bring on kind of new products and new flavors. Can you share with us what you have in store for this upcoming summer menu?
Of course. I am very excited when it comes to changing menus. Two things to it. One is that we are more productive and also using the seasonal product, which helps me to stick with our motto of like trying to use like the freshest ingredient possible and the local ingredient. 70% of our menu is based on local Utah products. And we get as creative as possible to minimize the transportation or, like I should say, cross-utilization of products. So we use a bunch of local vendors, and I've been in Utah for around 15 years, and I have this deep connection with deeper roots of the local farms and any cheesemakers in town. So I have, with the help of my team, have brought into the table of we have Wiener Schnitzel, which is, of course, you all know it's from the Austrian region, and it's one of the best product, and we tried to change all the sides that goes with it, like in a different context of like keeping it lighter for our summer, right? And then we also have our filet mignon, which comes from a Nyman ranch, and we have our Mary's chicken, which also is provided by Wasatch Meat Producers down here in Salt Lake. So far, I have tried to use mushrooms that comes from our local as well.
And so for something like Wiener Schnitzel, do you use local ingredients for that, or do you have to import those?
Definitely local ingredients. See, that's the challenge for most part. And at the same time, like we do have enough vendors here in Utah, which makes it easier for us to be more creative. To give you an example, yesterday I was walking around in the farmer's market, and I talked to a few of the vendors. I'm like, oh, I like what I see. Like, oh, let's work together. And it's not an immediate spark, if it makes any sense. Like, mm-hmm. We have to do a few different versions to see what works for us, like, and what meets our standard and all of those.
No, so it's definitely cultivating those relationships is a key role that you serve. Coming up on June 20th is the Solstice Celebration, and it's a flame-to-table dinner that you've created. Can you talk to us about this celebration?
Yes, I'm very excited for this one. I don't know if I was excited to do any of any of the other events that you've done. This one, I'm very, very excited. Well, it's a tradition in the Austrian and German region, or I should say the Bavarian region, since the 1300s. So during summer solstice, they just have this huge bonfire, and it's a huge gathering for the local community. And we're trying to use that concept, and basically I'm going to cook all our local products that we bring in from our local vendors on an open fire where the guests can watch me cook, and I'll explain to them those little details of like where the product's from. And we're also inviting the local vendors to have a little farmer's market just before we start our dinner, and then they're going to experience all, and the vendors are actually going to sit with our guests and talk about their products as well. For example, like Shea Nib chocolates down from Salt Lake and Gold Creek Farms, Salt Lake Brewing Company, and Caputo's Markets in Delhi. We also have Redmond Farms. So all of these vendors, they have this opportunity to mingle with the guest, and the guest has this unique experience of understanding where the products came from and how much it takes for our farmers to bring the product to the table.
So it's right.
We'll have live music there as well. Yeah.
And you'll also, it sounds like it's both a feast and an education, because you're going to sort of take the time to, you know, explain all this to your guests.
That is correct. And I do love to teach. I've been an adjunct professor at SLIC for 15 years, and I love to teach the chemistry of cooking itself. That's what, when you explain the why, people tend to understand the ingredients itself better when they have to substitute it. They have a better understanding of cooking itself.
And for that flame to table dinner, is that just one night, or is that, do you have a few seatings for that evening?
It is the first year, so we're doing it for only one night, and it's a limited 30 seating. And we are selling out fast, and if you're looking for a unique experience, this is, you probably need to go right away.
Okay. I understand you have another special event coming up. Tell us about what you're doing for the 4th of July.
4th of July, I'd like to marry the culture of the Austrian and the American cuisine, where, you know, we have barbecues for 4th of July. So how am I going to marry that? We have the Bavarian style briskets, which is soaked in beer and cooked overnight, technically between 24 to 32 hours in beer, braised. And then we'll take it out and smoke it for the next 8 hours. And that's what our guests get to experience it. So something as much as possible. I love this infusion cuisine, and helps me get creative. Of course, the whole point is to like giving the Utah's signature ingredients to our guest.
No, and that sounds like an amazing event in marrying the two cultures. And speaking of marrying cultures, you have a background with Indian cuisine as well. Have you been able to take your culture and career experience and blend it with your position as the executive director or executive chef at Goldner Hirsch?
Definitely. Culturally speaking, freshness means something different for me. While I grew up in a small French town in southern India, so for me, fresh ingredient is like we go to the market and buy it and cook it within the next 30 minutes. And these products come straight from the farm. So I try my best to influence that culture to like understand the freshness of a product, and as fresh as you can actually get it. I grew up in a coastal town, so for me, any seafood is basically like I have to buy it right when the boats are docking. So to commemorate that, like I found this company in Hawaii who will basically call me what they caught from the boat right after they caught, and then they send me pictures, and I tell them like what product I exactly want before they dock. It's already processed and it's in a box, and the next day morning within 12 hours I have it in the restaurant to serve it, so which gives the best quality and the freshness that I that I expect, and which is also a standard practice in the Oberge Resort Collection.
Sorry, just to ask, though, it sounds like an amazing place where you had grown up, a coastal French village in India? Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. If you have seen the movie Life of Pi, the first 20 minutes is my hometown. It's called Pondicherry.
Ah, what a wonderful place. Well, as listeners have listened today, I'm sure they want to find out more about Goldener Hirsch and the dining options available. Can you let our listeners know where they can find out more about the property?
Oh, definitely. You can go to aubergeresorts.com/GoldenerHirsch/dining, and you will find all of our latest dining options, including every single event we do, and where we do have a link to buy tickets for our summer solstice menu.
I'm sure many listening are interested in that. We've been spending time this morning with Goldener Hirsch's executive chef, Senthil Krishnamurthy. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Of course. I would love to invite you all to Goldener Hirsch on June 20th for our summer solstice celebration. Please go on Eventbrite to find some tickets, or go to our website, goldenerhirsch.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.